Mark time. There's halt. Ready, stop. Ready, stop. Ready, stop.
This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. Sound here from Washington today. Those are military pallbearers carrying the casket of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg up the steps of the Capitol, the first woman to lay in state. Her death resonated deeply throughout the Commonwealth's political and legal communities this week. And it is the culmination of an intense week of news where it seemed every story hit close to home. Protests right here in Boston over the Breonna Taylor charging decisions.
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
A fight to put kids in the Commonwealth's classrooms, another woman of color seeks to make history in Boston's mayoral race, and new criminal charges today from A.G. Maura Healey's office on the COVID-19 outbreak at the Holyoke Soldiers' Home.
We owed it to the families who lost loved ones and these veterans who served our country to get to the bottom of what happened.
And we will begin there with you and our panelists. Call us. What is your reaction to the charges in the Holyoke Soldiers' Home case? And on the rest of the news this week, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So joining us now are our panelists, both remote, of course. First, we have Seti Warren, the executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and former mayor of Newton. Seti, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Also with us is Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and principal of Chippio Strategies. Charlie, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Charlie, let's jump right in. Is this an appropriate use of prosecutorial power from Attorney General Healey?
Yeah, look, I believe it is. I mean, I think she said it well in the sense that, you know, the families of the that lost loved ones as a result of things that clearly could have been avoided at the Holyoke Soldiers Home. I think they deserve justice. And, you know, it's not one of those things that gives you any pleasure to see the people indicted in this case. But I just think that there has to be some kind of a response to that kind of, I don't know a better word than incompetence, frankly.
Seti, I wanna play a little sound. I was struck by a sort of an impassioned portion of Healey's remarks today as she was announcing charges in the Holyoke Soldiers' Home case. Here she is.
They risked their lives from the beaches of Normandy to some the jungles of Vietnam. And to know that they died under the most horrific circumstances is truly shocking.
I wanted to ask you this because what she's saying does bring home this sense of egregiousness, but the legal outrage shouldn't rest on whether they served their country or went through life completely unremarked, right? I mean, so many people could die from neglect, carelessness, poor judgment during this pandemic.
Well, you know, it certainly resonates with me personally. I'm an Iraq War veteran. I've been a part of the veterans community for many, many years. So I too join in the outrage. You know, I trust that the Attorney General, these are serious criminal charges. I trust the Attorney General's judgment when it comes to these types of things. But I think it also raises the question of what was happening before COVID-19 there. And maybe in some other places where veterans are under the care of various agencies, you know, this kind of egregious behavior doesn't just happen because of the pandemic. So I'd like to see a wider look beyond the criminal charges of how we're caring for our veterans. Do we have the policies and procedures in place to ensure that when there's wrongdoing that goes on and that is remedied, do we have the proper care in place for our veterans?
Yeah, let's actually listen to a little more then. Here she is again talking about the charges.
Walsh and Clinton were responsible for the decision to combine 42 veterans, some COVID positive and others not even showing any symptoms of COVID, into a single unit that usually accommodates 25 beds.
So she was talking there about their administrative decisions, and she went on to answer a question later, basically saying the law does need to change about the qualifications of people running the Holyoke Soldiers Home, and that she was going to look at charges in other instances as well. Is this a necessary reckoning, Charlie?
Yeah, look, I think it is. I think one thing that's important to point out there is that this all did not happen, you know, in the second week in March or something when all this stuff was hitting us and we sort of had no idea what was going on. As I understand it, these things happened, you know, toward the end of April, at which time we clearly knew better than that kind of behavior.
So, Seti, that brings in one other thing, which is the irony of the fact that Bennett Walsh was being reinstated by the courts this week because Charlie Baker's administration didn't fire him correctly. Here is Baker addressing that particular court ruling earlier this week.
It's our expectation, given the judge's ruling with respect to who has the authority to fire at Holyoke Soldiers Home, that we would expect the board, based on the Perlstein report, which made pretty clear that there were serious mistakes made over the course of the months of February and March, that they would act to remove Bennett Walsh permanently.
So an administrative mistake in executing sort of the penalty of oversight after it was the administration that was overseeing the Holyoke Soldiers Home, you know, before this happened, should there be more accountability for Charlie Baker and his team than we have seen?
Well, we certainly, you know, I've run, you know, bureaucracies before. This certainly deserves a look back just to review policy procedure and decision-making. And I trust the governor will take a look at that. He is a systems individual. He's a data individual. So I'd expect a look back would be appropriate in a scenario like this, particularly a serious scenario like this when people's lives are at stake.
All right, I do want to switch gears here. And listeners, I want to invite you to switch gears with us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Because we're going to talk now about the candidacy of Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell for mayor of Boston. She got in this week as another woman of color trying to make history in the city at a time when challengers are getting traction against incumbents in elections. Charlie Chipio, were you surprised to see her jump into the race?
No, I wouldn't say that I was surprised. I mean, I think clearly it's a long shot candidacy. Obviously, Mayor Walsh is in a strong position. She doesn't, I think, have the kind of name recognition out there that Michelle Wu does, another member of the city council who's also entered the race. But, you know, there's a long tradition of these sort of long shot candidacies for mayor. And, I can definitely understand where some of these folks might think they've had enough of the city council and why not take a shot at it.
Seti, as a former mayor, I wanted to ask you, we know that she'd been deliberating on this for a while. And of course, she had her campaign answer for why she entered. But it is a stretch for anyone to beat an incumbent mayor in Boston, assuming Walsh runs. And she enters with Michelle Wu, another formidable city councilor already claiming territory in this race. What do you think made her decide to go for it? What happens in a candidate's head when they say, yeah, I'm going to do it?
Well, as a person that's had to make decisions about running a number of times, it's a very sort of personal process. And I think ultimately, you know, a candidate makes a decision based on whether they're the right person for the moment. Yeah, I think we have to recognize that we are, you know, at a historic tipping point in the United States in regard to race. Certainly, the events of COVID-19 has exposed the inequities in all of our cities around the country, not just Boston. And certainly, you know, the vivid imagery of George Floyd has really awakened a sense in people who are not African-American to the systemic racism. So I think we have to respect the moment. We have to pay attention to the moment. And, you know, I haven't talked to Councilor Campbell, so I don't know what into her decision-making, but I would assume that she saw this as a moment that she could meet because of those factors, because of the historic challenges for people of color in Massachusetts. I assume that what probably went into her thinking.
You know,
that's actually related to that. Oh, Charlie, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, related to that, I think we're also at a tipping point in terms of politics, right? I mean, for years, you know, it's legend for those of us of a certain age, you know, Sam Yoon, who tried to challenge Mayor Menino many years ago and, you know, was never seen in Boston again, and you compare that to, I think, the what was kind of symbolic was what happened with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when she came out of nowhere to win the primary and become a member of Congress. I think now,
or Ayanna Pressley straight out of the city council,
Pressley,
Charlie.
Exactly. And I think now these challenges that in the past were kind of seen as folly, we kind of don't know what to expect, you know, because you have exactly the Ayanna Pressleys, but then you have now I'm blanking on his name, who is the younger guy who tried to challenge William Galvin, but, you know, got beat 2-1. He was a city councilor as well.
Josh Zakim.
Exactly. Josh Zakim. Yeah. You know, so it's really kind of a crazy environment out there that's much harder to pick or foresee what's going to happen than it has been in the past.
I want to put a little of her voice in here. Here is Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell on Radio Boston when she announced that she would be running.
Being born and raised in the city of Boston and a product of Boston Public Schools, I find that when I continue to share more pieces of my story, it inspires others to do the same. And so now I look forward to running for mayor, not only to share a story, of course, to listen to others share theirs, but to work on dismantling systems that perpetuate inequities in the city of Boston.
And Sadie, I think this kind of picks up on what you were saying before. She makes a strong case that her lived experience in Boston, the education, the death of her twin brother, Andre, in our criminal justice system is key to her being able to connect with voters and address their lived experiences. We know that if Walsh runs, he can run in his bio. This is interesting because Michelle Wu wasn't born and raised here. She's running on her bio, but she was born in Chicago. And I wonder, does that create an especial... It's not really a real word, but you know what I mean? Liability for Wu running against a homegrown, right, Charlie, opponent like Andrea Campbell. You know, she announced today she raised $50,000 in her first 24 hours.
Yeah, I think there is something to that, and maybe not a liability for Michelle Wu, who's an incredible sort of talent, but an opportunity for Councillor Campbell. I remember when I was running for mayor of Newton, I was a product of Newton, and I could speak to the city and you know, the challenges it's had over decades, as well as the opportunity. And that resonated with a lot of people where they knew that I was born and raised and ingrained in the city. But, you know, I do have to say for the challengers, you know, we are in a scenario where, unlike congressional races, you know, the buck stops at the mayor's desk every single day. And they're going to be judged on how they would handle COVID-19. They're going to be judged on, you know, how they would manage the schools and ensure that there's quality education for all, transportation in the city, housing. So I think it's a different race to the extent that you're talking about management and being a chief executive leadership. And I think there's a difference between the two. And that's a challenge when you're running against an incumbent.
Charlie, last question on this. Mayor Walsh has good marks for his handling of the pandemic. And I wonder if that makes him, that puts a little Teflon around him, or are we in such a time of change that nothing makes him Teflon in the city now?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, Teflon, with possible exception of all the things that President Trump seems to get away with, Teflon is awfully hard to achieve. But I think that certainly is that is a big help. I think the fact that he's well liked, within the political community as well, he's forged the kind of relationship he has with Governor Baker. I think all of these things, are certainly going to help him in his run.
Listen, this was a week of breaking news locally, but also a week of grief and anger. And it seems we have a lot of those in 2020. Listeners, we're going to turn to three national stories now that resonated so deeply here in the Commonwealth this week that even the relatively taciturn Charlie Baker spoke passionately about all three of them. In a little bit, we're going to discuss the charging decisions in Louisville, Kentucky this week, in the police killing of Breonna Taylor, and the new questions about the peaceful transfer of power after the November elections. But we want to start with how the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg affected you this week. Call with your memories, with what you think the nation lost, and how are you feeling about the ensuing Supreme Court battle? How should we reform our police when we talk about Breonna Taylor and a number of other questions that we'll do during this time? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Seti and Charlie, I want to play a little more sound for you here.
Psalms 118, verse 5.
Okay, that is Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt singing Min HaMetzar in the Capitol Rotunda today as Ruth Bader Ginsburg's casket lay in state, the first woman to lay in state. We're hearing from so many members of our community today also how remarkable it is to hear a rabbi in the rotunda. Why does her loss seem to resonate so deeply here in the Commonwealth? I have been, and we have been, hearing from people on this all week. Seti.
You know, I think her efforts to build case law then on the Supreme Court, her decisions and dissent to create a completely different world for women in education in the workplace and men was generational. And I think that many people recognize that, even those that were not born when she was building that case law and making decisions. And I also believe that this demonstrates the generational decision around the next appointment and the fears that some have. But I think that this was a significant loss in the passing as one of the leaders in our country in creating equality. And I think that's why we're feeling this effect, I think many of us around the Commonwealth and the country.
Charlie, you know, Seti just made reference. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I think that is true, you know, absolutely true. I mean, a great legal mind, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, it's funny, I think of two other kind of examples come to my mind. One, I think about why she touched people as much as she did. I mean, one, just as my own, you know, I happen to be at a Rosh Hashanah gathering on Friday night, socially distanced outdoors, when the news came through. And it was just, it was fascinating to me. I'm not Jewish, but the reaction among the folks I was there with about, you know, the pride they had, you know, in Justice Ginsburg for her brilliance, but also her kindness, you know, and the fact that she was a Jewish woman. I mean, it sort of reminded me of the reaction my mother would have had if Justice Ginsburg was, you know, an Italian chief justice or court justice, you know. But the other thing, I was fortunate enough to hear her speak at New England Law School about 10 years ago, and you know, there's a reason why she, I think, became such a kind of a cultural icon. She was so unlike the average politician or public figure that you would hear. You know, it was like going to get advice from your kindly grandmother, except for your kindly grandmother who had a 200 IQ, you know. I mean, there was something so unique and relatable and just likable about her. And I think that really is a big part of why she has had the impact that clearly she's had.
Yes, she was iconic, and she broke ground on so many fronts of the people that we talked to this week. I want to give you a little bit of former federal judge Nancy Gertner, who knew Justice Ginsburg well and was reflecting on her.
The loss of really more than just a vote, more than just an icon. She was a force in the legal community and significantly had been for you know, 40 years, and she was a friend, and she was a role model for us, although that is such an overused term. She was what I wanted to be.
You know, as a woman who I think maybe at one point in my career really thought, boy, Nancy Gertner would be a cool person to be, to hear Nancy Gertner tell me that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was who she wanted to be was really striking. And it makes me want to ask, did we mourn her for long enough before it got nasty? I mean, we went straight into the Supreme Court battle. Our own Ed Markey was among the early to draw the battle lines, you know, block Trump on this, pack the court if he does it. Did we have to go there right away? And did we mourn her for long enough? Either of you.
I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive. I mean, I feel like we are still mourning her. But did we jump to the battlefront too quickly? Yeah, I mean, absolutely, we did. But I don't. I almost don't know how you avoid it in the current sort of, you know, the current environment that is just so toxic.
I think if we don't understand our history, we can't actually make correct decisions for the future. So this question that you're asking is really important. You know, my daughter, who's 12 years old, knew who Ruth Bader Ginsburg was. How many 12-year-olds could name a Supreme Court justice? I mean, and she knew that she was a champion for equality. And we had discussions about her. I think that it's so important to understand how the work that she did, what she established, before you can actually start to articulate what the future should look like, even the future of the Supreme Court. So I do think there is something to, really understanding who she was and what she did for the United States.
I want to take a call here, 800-423-8255, to join this conversation. We've got Ellen on the line from Attleboro. Ellen, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for doing this show. She was such a role model for people like me. I'm 61, and I was raised by a mother who was a feminist, but in her day, her father didn't believe that women should be educated. So my mother was pretty much a genius, but only got to go to secretarial school, and that always weighed heavy on her. So she impressed on her three girls that they should do what they felt they wanted to do, and I picked an athletic sport. I was an equestrian, and I swam, and I would often get, when I'd climb off the tractor, being working on a farm as a farm manager, oh, you do that really good as a girl, you know, or for a girl.
Yeah.
And
there
I'd
you
look
go,
at
Ellen.
Some of these, well, I'd look at some of these workmen and say, no, I do it really well because I started driving tractors when I was 9.
There
it has
go.
Nothing to do with me being a girl. And I was very powerful because I was an athlete. And that surprised them.
We're going to take it back from you there, Ellen. I love you adding that voice and that point in, especially as someone who learned to drive a tractor at a very young age myself. I just love that. And Charlie and Seti, I hear you both laughing about that. But, you know, there is also something to the fact that she just broke ceiling after ceiling after ceiling. And I don't want to lose that ground. We have plenty of women leading now, but it does always feel a little scary when you lose someone who's broken so much ground. Are you going to lose any of the ground with them?
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, she, in a way, she makes me think of Jackie Robinson, you know, she broke so much new ground and just the, you know, did it with such grace. I just couldn't imagine, you know, doing that myself. And, you know, it's leaves you speechless. It really is incredible.
Well, no, I agree. I mean, you think about Thurgood Marshall, who reimagined what life could be like for Black children and setting up the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Similarly, you know, Justice Ginsburg reimagined what life would be like for girls and women growing up, and then women in the workplace, women and education, having an equal opportunity, whether it's around salary or even breaking into different fields. So I think you are right to raise the question of a fear of slipping back. You know, there needs to be forward progress. If there isn't, then we do have the opportunity to slide back.
So I, you know, there's more to talk about here, but I there's some other things I don't want to shortchange. So let's talk about the charging decisions for Breonna Taylor now. You know, in 2020, it feels like grief over one thing at a time is never enough. So now we've got these charged decisions this week. One former detective is charged for wanton endangerment, but for endangering the neighbors, no charges specifically for Breonna Taylor's death. We've already got a call on this. So 800-423-8255. I'm going to let Gordon from Malden have the first word. Gordon, go ahead.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. My point is this, is that if the police were really concerned about equality, they would be protesting. They would be protesting racism. But they aren't, because the police were created to enforce white supremacy, and they still do. And white people don't know that, because the way society is organized, where the way towns are set up, your tax dollars, it's all segregated. That's why for white people, we don't go to Chelsea. I only went to Chelsea because I worked there as a social worker, and I got to know what was going on. And then I worked in prison in Massachusetts.
Gordon, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thank you for the call. And it is an interesting thing to take this all the way to, you know, we have posed this, the national conversation has posed this as a conflict between the police and protesters. And Gordon is saying everyone could be on the streets together about this one. City Warren, how are you reflecting on it?
Look, I have a few thoughts around this. First and foremost, it's a tragedy in the sense that we don't really understand what happened in that grand jury. We really need to understand the public, the community, what evidence was presented to that grand jury to lead them to indicting one individual who is not involved with shooting Breonna Taylor. So that's one. And so we need to have that needs to come out. We need to understand that. I think second, and this goes beyond policing, we can't just focus on the actions of those police officers. We have to. But the second thing is, and this is where we get into the caller's concern and my concern about the more systemic problems around race and law enforcement. How did that warrant get issued and why? There are a lot of questions about why those police officers ended up at that door, you know, breaking it down, essentially, when we know the question was whether there was drug activity in that at that apartment, led by Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, who's incarcerated.
Ex-boyfriend, who's incarcerated.
Third, and this is what I think the caller was getting to, there's a larger question around policing. Again, we need to focus on those officers and making sure there's justice there, but we need to go and look at how police are trained before they even get to a police department, what their mission is, what the mission of police are. And this goes back decades and even a couple hundred years about why the police were created, what their mission is. We know there's over-policing, for example, and underserved communities and communities of color. So when we think about these systemic issues, we must not just focus on the behavior of those officers. We need to look at the systems that are in place that lead to the breaking down of a door with a warrant and the shooting of this innocent victim.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm just going to. Charlie, before I turn to you, I want to just read out a couple of things. The city has since banned no-knock warrants. According to the AP, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron said the officers acted in self-defense after Taylor's boyfriend, who the apartment she was in, her boyfriend was with her, after they fired. This is what the AG said, and it also gets to the point of why people, as Seti Warren is saying, are calling to hear more about what was presented to the grand jury. He added that the officer that was charged, Detective Hankinson, and the two other officers who entered Taylor's apartment announced themselves before entering. It sounds like there's some dispute, depending on who you talk to, about that, and therefore didn't actually execute the warrant as no knock. That's according to the AP. And I just want to put that out there as part of the context where we're having this conversation, because it gets to Seti's point about wanting more information about what actually happened that night. Charlie, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just building on that and on a few of the things that that Seti said, look, this issue of grand jury secrecy, you know, this is we really do have to do something. I mean, we need to know what was put forth, what was put before that grand jury. You know, I think grand jury secrecy may be one of the reforms we need to look at. You know, its time may have passed. And I don't know, logically, I wonder, you know, there seems to be some disagreement about whether the officers did announce themselves. I just really wonder about the logic of going through the extra effort to seek a no-knock warrant if you're just going to announce yourself anyway. You know, finally, in terms of the police training, yeah, that really, we really need some serious police reform in this country. And, you know, I would, the first thing that has to happen, I think it needs to be the end of qualified immunity, you know, that insulates police from so many of the mistakes, either mistakes or, you know, in more rare instances, things that they, you know, do intentionally that are, you know, that are you know, need to stop. And I think that we do, you know, we have seen a lot of progress when it comes to criminal justice reform. I did a little work on that and got pretty familiar with it. And a lot of good things have come from that. And I think that that needs to really be the prelude to the next step, which is some serious police reform.
To that point, I want to play a little bit from Michael Curry, former head of the Boston branch of the NAACP, on our show yesterday.
We're in a moment right now that there's a police reform bill in the legislature and conference committee. That bill could come out of conference watered down, and we might not meet the moment, right? That's the challenge we have when we march in the street. You got to show up for the legislation. You got to call the members of your congressional delegation, or in this case, the legislature, and demand that the bill meet the moment.
Seti, the bill has been in the legislature in negotiation for a while, and I increasingly hear people express concern that allows the momentum to fade and that it will weaken the bill over time. Do you think the legislature will pass a bill for the moment?
Look, my good friend Michael Curry, I didn't hear that clip, but he's absolutely correct. And it's really incumbent upon the residents of Massachusetts to understand this and contact their legislators. If they care about ensuring that there is justice when there is injustice in regard to law enforcement, if they want to make sure that Black people feel safe in their cities and towns, this is a moment. And as we know, this is a representative government. So Michael's correct that the only way these things move is if the constituents that the representatives hear from, that they're hearing from their constituents.
So before we go to break, I do want to spend just a couple of minutes on one other national story, because so many of them really came home. And this one did too. This is Governor Charlie Baker yesterday, who actually got angry defending mail-in voting in the Commonwealth and defending the integrity of our election process in light of President Donald Trump's comments about the peaceful transition of power this week. Here he is.
One way or another, the people are going to speak in November, and those of us who serve in public life will do everything we can to make sure that the people's will is followed through and executed on. Because that is fundamentally why there's a United States of America in the first place.
I want to ask the two of you, this is Radio Boston. We talk about the Commonwealth. We talk about Greater Boston. We talk about our communities. That is a national story. But when we hear our governor that upset, what should be the reaction in the Commonwealth to the president's remarks this week that we ought to essentially throw out the ballots and that he will not promise to a peaceful transition of power? And what can the Commonwealth do? Charlie?
Well, my question is, what do you have to do to lose an election in this country? I've been watching this stuff for a long time. I'm older than both of you guys, and I'm not, you know, I'm in the center. No one would call me a liberal. But what this president has done is so offensive on a daily basis. And, you know, this just being the latest. I mean, we have, for certainly for my entire life, we have taken American democracy and we have taken the rule of law. We have taken these things for granted. And now you see these situations, you know, this article in The Atlantic that is getting so much attention about all the different ways that you know, this election could end up in complete chaos. We have to get serious about this, folks. I mean, it is time to put aside all the various resentments that all of us have about a number of issues and say, look, this is a matter of standing up for democracy. I'm thrilled at what Governor Baker said. You know, I take some hope in the comments of what Liz Cheney and Marco Rubio and Mitt Romney and a few Republicans who were just kind of drew the line on this, although not nearly as forcefully as I think they should have. But boy, I mean, this, I have never felt American democracy, even certainly during Watergate, so challenged during my lifetime.
Seti, I want to go to a break in about a minute, but I want to give you a chance to weigh in here before I do.
Sure. Look, there's two sort of entities that need to be strong in describing how voting happens in every state. It's good the governor did that, but people need to have an understanding that different states will have the results out at different times, depending on the state. The media has a responsibility, and so do elected officials. And that communication and understanding and education needs to start right now.
That is critical. We need to go into election night knowing, with putting out the information about who is likely to vote on that day, what their
Correct.
Demographics are, who is
Yes.
likely, whose votes are likely to come in later, what that
That's
means.
Right.
You know, that people need to understand that.
Yes.
We're going to talk for a couple of minutes here about the state's choice this week to ask 16 school districts to submit new plans for getting young people, learners, into school in the building or face a potential audit. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Governor Baker seems to kind of be one of our through lines on this whole week of news. The latest is this kerfuffle as his administration picks this fight with the 16 districts. Here is the governor yesterday when asked if his administration is bullying schools.
When most people in the education and the public health and the pediatric community all believe that in-person learning, especially for young kids, is a critical part of their educational and social development, we want to know what your plan is to get back. I don't think that's bullying. I think it's a perfectly appropriate question to ask on behalf of the people of those communities and especially the kids.
Charlie Chipio, is this the right fight for the governor to be picking around schools?
Well, I think there are a lot of fights to be picked around schools, but this one, I have to tell you, I'm really of two minds on this one, and it's entirely personal. On one hand, I teach, I'm an adjunct professor, and so I've been teaching now for, what amounts to about a full semester now online. I would certainly rather be doing it in person. It's more effective in person. There's no doubt about that. The other part of me is that, I have a daughter who's a senior in high school and she suffers from asthma. And, you know, so she is, she's at risk for COVID. And I am scared of the fact that, where I live in Needham is a hybrid plan. And so she'll actually be going in for the first time next week. And that scares me. And to be honest, I'm sort of trying to weigh these two things in my mind. And I'm not sure I've come to a great conclusion yet.
Seti, earlier in the summer, the administration, the Baker administration had been pretty clear that these decisions were up to the school districts. And this change made me think of when President Trump early on left acquisition of PPE to the states, but then declared total authority over the coronavirus response maybe, 8 weeks later. Are the superintendents in these school districts getting mixed messages from the state on who's calling the shots? And if so, how does that affect their ability to function?
Well, I come at this as a former local elected official, as well as a parent of a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, and two decision points. And I think Charlie hit upon one of them. I think as a parent, there's great concern and obviously fear and protection of your children. I'm sure a lot of those superintendents, town managers, and otherwise are hearing from their constituents saying, what are you going to do to protect my children? So I think there are a lot of questions there, and there's a lot of fear of the unknown. The second piece of this, as a former local elected official, as a mayor, pre-COVID, we know across the state there are a number of disparities as far as the quality of the buildings, the quality of ventilation in these buildings. Some of these school buildings are very old. They certainly don't, hit the standard of some of the requirements that the health experts are talking about. So there are more questions than answers in your question and what the governor's trying to do. So I think that, you see a divide happening between public schools and private schools. There are a number of private schools that are fully open right now, but they have testing. They're testing their students every week to ensure they're safe, and they're putting measures in place in these buildings. Whereas, the public schools may not have those sorts of resources to do testing, retrofits, and otherwise. So I think there's got to be a moment of recognition around this. And it's not just the local town, it's not just the state, but there's also a responsibility of the federal government, not to open up the doors too wide here, but, we still have not seen movement on this relief bill at the national level. Part of that relief bill is actually funding to help address some of the concerns I just mentioned at the local level. So there's an intersection here of all these questions, not just the local community, but the questions around inequity and allowing kids to get back safely or be educated safely.
I want to throw one call in on this. We've got Bob on the line from Truro. Bob, go ahead.
So I'm actually a Boston and Truro resident. I'm right now hibernating down here. But I'm more concerned with the governor intruding into local situations where they're the best on the ground to know the condition of the schools, the condition of their teachers, what they're trying to accomplish, what the parents are feeling. And, it's lovely that he thinks that he should do this, but I think it's intrusive and he shouldn't be. I've been meaning to call the State House all day since I read about this morning.
Well, I'm glad you called us, Bob.
More local. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm sorry to cut you off, Bob, but I want to get one more call in here. I want to get Dave in from Jamaica Plain. Dave, briefly, go ahead.
Okay, I'm supporting the governor on this one. I think the kids need to get back in the building. I think a lot of school systems are just looking for the push, to be perfectly honest with you. They need to get their kids, especially the younger ones. I mean, high school kids can do it online. If we had a timeline, it would be better is when we could finally get everyone back in. But the truth is, it's not good enough what we're doing. And we're trying. Trust me, I've been sitting in front of a computer screen for 7 hours a day for the last 8 days. We're trying, but it's not going to work. We need to get the kids back.
Thank you, Dave. And I just want to note, Dave, I believe, is a teacher, just to explain him saying that he's been sitting in front of the computer screen for 7 hours a day. So, Charlie and Seti, there's more that we could say there, but we are starting to get down to the end of time. I think it's great to give our callers sort of the last voices on that, because before we run out of time, I do want to make sure that we can fit in our hubbubs. They're important to us on Fridays. They're those local stories or events that caught our attention this week, and I do want to leave time for them. Seti, what's yours?
Look, Fenway Park's going to be open for early voting. I think that's fantastic. I think it's important. Some other ballparks are doing it around the country. We need to make voting as accessible as possible for all people, whether they're in person, mail-in, early, or day of. So I was really pleased to see that. I hope it's a model for other places around the country.
Can you imagine voting in Fenway Park?
Well, just being able to go on the field would be something. Maybe folks will change their mind as far as in person based on.
It's going to cause voter fraud. I'm going to vote 10 times.
Charlie, don't say that, Charlie Chippio. All right, Charlie, what's your hubbub for this week?
Well, we've been talking today about a bunch of issues that have caused the American justice system to be under scrutiny. Between Breonna Taylor and a president who won't pledge to leave if he loses the election in November. But fear not, Florida prosecutors have dropped the solicitation of prostitution charges against Patriots owner Robert Kraft. Florida State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg isn't happy about it. He took some shots at Kraft's wealth. He said individuals with significant means have the ability to hire the best lawyers and investigators to dissect every decision point made by law enforcement to find a weak spot and then exploit it to achieve an acquittal or a dismissal, he said, explicitly calling out economic inequities in the justice system. I don't know what would lead him to say that. Maybe he got the wrong idea based on Kraft arriving at the Orchids of Asia day spa on consecutive days in different chauffeur-driven Bentleys. But we shall see.
All right. Well, so there we've got Sox with no baseball. We've got Pats with no football. I was going to do a story about a rock that fell over in Holliston, but now I feel like I have to do sports. I'm going to do basketball with some actual basketball, because this might be, and I hope not, but it might be your last chance to watch a Boston team play in a playoff, at least for a while. The Celtics are in the fight of their lives in the NBA playoffs. It is game five against the Miami Heat tonight. They are down 1-3. It's an 8:30 game, and we've been trying to get our listeners more and more into sports because Chris Siderick, our producer, loves them. I love them. If you don't know basketball, tonight is still going to be an incredible game. It's going to be incredible, exciting, a brawl. So I would tell people to watch it. All right, that is our week in review. Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Seti Warren, executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Always great to be with you. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Glenn Alexander. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening, and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.